Welcome into the Call It A Podcast, powered by CLNS Media. We're recording on Tuesday, April 2nd at about 6:30. New format to the show. We kind of glossed over it last week because we wanted to get everything in. But just a reminder, this is what we're going to be doing now, 2 to 3 shows a week, about 20 to 25 minutes, really focused on one solo topic. It allows us to get to more. It allows us to get more in depth. Frankly, it's easier for the two of us. So we're going to at least try this out probably for a month or two. We'll see how it goes. And if we like it, we'll stick with it. If not, we'll go back to the old format or try something new. That being said, new format does leave less time for pleasantries. So Alex Lebowitz, I'm going to turn this into a multiple choice question. How are you doing? Yes or no? Good or bad?
I'll go yes.
Okay, how are you doing? Yes.
I'm doing yes. I'm doing good. I'm doing grim. I'm wonderful. Chris Farley, Billy Madison.
So I'm a little surprised to hear you say that, because last time we talked, all the optimism in the world, the Celtics were struggling, the Bruins were, I mean, not struggling, but they'd gotten kind of, we're ready for the playoffs. All the optimism in the world was based on the Red Sox, and that has not gone well. The silver lining to that is really none of the MLB teams that were expected to be good this year have gotten off to positive starts. So let's start right there before we get into the Red Sox. You have the Yankees, who struggled with the lowly Baltimore Orioles, a team that fire sailed. You have a team like the Cubs that's towards the bottom of their division. The Astros have been slow out of the gate. I know it's been less than 1 week, but you know, I'm looking at it as, okay, there's something either going on around the league or whatever it is that I don't think the Red Sox are falling behind because they're still right there on par with all the good teams. Is that too optimistic? I don't know. I feel like maybe I'm being too much of a homer with that.
No, listen, you're starting the season in March.
Right.
So I think that plays a factor. And it's going to take some time for people to get into that, you know, mid-season form, obviously. This is probably more extreme than we've seen in years past, specifically with the starting pitching with the Red Sox from what I've seen. But I expect this to kind of come around. For the most part, but overall, you have seen that. That said, hey, the Mariners are 6-1 right now.
And look, people are down on them because they sold off most of their talent in the offseason, but they got something in return for all that talent. I don't know that they're going to go out and win a World Series, but they have some interesting young pieces there. Although that reliever, what's his name? Garen, I forget his first name. I got to pull this up real quick. I'm guessing you saw, you didn't see the game, but you saw the highlights. Takes forever to throw pitches, just in between Corey Garen. Like a minute between pitches, couldn't throw a strike. At one point, he'd thrown 11 balls in 12 pitches.
No, that was Sunday night, right?
Yeah. Did you see that?
Yeah, that was a 4 o'clock game.
That one.
He was brutal. That was awful.
And he's not a baseball player. I don't know what he is, but he's certainly not a baseball player.
He looks like, I'm looking at his profile right now, he looks like he's a hockey player with the mullet. Kind of looks Kenny Powers-esque, but he's from Chattanooga, so that kind of removes any possibility of that. But that was awful. And I love Dennis Eckersley during that. He's awesome. I love that.
You want to talk about midseason form. Dennis Eckersley has come out just firing bullets.
He's been phenomenal, and he was heated that this guy was taking so long.
I thought he was going to go down to the clubhouse and beat the crap out of him after that game.
I hope he would, but he speaks for all of us. If you're gonna take 40 seconds between pitches, 50 seconds between pitches, throw strikes. This guy threw, I think, 2 strikes on like 13 pitches, and that's including, you know, a pop fly out from Xander Bogaerts, from what I remember. So that was brutal. The game was ridiculously long. And the Red Sox, the one consolation is they've been making some comeback efforts. Obviously, they didn't get it done Sunday.
Although,
one time previously,
some of those were more help from the Mariners than efforts on their own part. I mean, go back to the, 3 errors in a row at third base to close out the third game of that series. But let's put it in this context here again, big picture. And look, we're one time through the rotation, not even for a couple of teams. And the biggest divisional deficit in the league right now is only, I believe, 4. Yes, it's 4 games, which what's 4 games? It's really nothing. But this is what we do. We overreact early in the season. God knows we do it during the NFL season. After one game, we drastically change everything we've been saying for 2-3 months during training camp. Mm-hmm. But you have the Red Sox in last place. The Yankees in third. They just dropped 2-4 to a team that's supposed to be one of the worst in baseball, to the Orioles. The Indians have two teams ahead of them in their division. The Angels and Astros are at the bottom of the AL West. The Braves were supposed to compete. They're 1-3. The Cubs are 1-3. You know, that's a number of teams that people were looking at going into the season thinking these guys are going to be factors come October. Of those teams I mentioned, or if maybe there's another, who should have the biggest reason for concern? Because we can talk about the silver lining for the Red Sox all we want, and there is some for the Yankees too, and there is for the Cubs and the Braves. Who's kidding themselves the most by saying, oh, this start's just an anomaly?
I wouldn't say that's the reason I think they should be the most concerned. But I think the Yankees have some issues, specifically injury-wise. You have a guy like Andujar who's been dealing with being banged up. Obviously, Pineda is going to be out. Not Pineda. Luis Severino, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Severino is going to be out till at least May 1st from what I saw. That might be later now. And then isn't, you know, Giancarlo Stanton dealing with some injuries?
Yeah, didn't they put Judge on the DL-IL? Sorry, we're going to, you know what? I'm going to establish something right now, Lebowitz. We're calling it the DL on this show. 25 years I've been calling it the DL. It is. It will always be the disabled list for me. That is going to be a calling it rule right there.
Okay.
We will call it the disabled list on this show. If people want to call us out for being wrong, at Real Alex Barth on Twitter, so be it. It's the disabled list. Sorry, continue.
It is funny how that changed. And it's taken some getting used to. But you look at – they have, you know, Severino's out. Betances is dealing with injury. And Duhar and against Stanton. Match that with Aaron Hicks. They just can't stay healthy. So I think the issue that the Yankees are dealing with right now are really the benefit they're dealing with the benefit of a slow start from the Red Sox, but the reality is the Red Sox are healthy. They have their roster returning with the exception of a couple guys from last season. So they'll be able to kind of get into the swing of things. At least ideally you'd think so. The Yankees, I just don't know if personnel wise they'd be able to do that given all those key contributors who are dealing with injury for the time being. So I think the team that should be the most concerned right now, is the Yankees simply because, you know, that could be a big hole that they fall into if the Red Sox start playing well, and that AL East is going to be really competitive this season.
So I actually think the Yankees are okay. I mean, don't get me wrong. They have some serious injury concerns, but it's more about who's around them. The Red Sox didn't get off to a hot start, so they didn't lose too much ground. I don't think the Rays, Orioles, or Blue Jays are going to keep this up. I mean, I think the Yankees will have a chance to regain their ground. They certainly do have some concerns, but in context of, you know, falling into a hole early, who should be the most worried? I would say a team like the Astros. I know that they maybe have the most talented roster in the American League from top to bottom, but like we talked about on the last show, I think that, you know, they've been playing at such a high level for so long, eventually they have to come back down to the norm. And there is some young talent in Oakland and Seattle that I like. Now, it's going to take a lot for those teams to overpower Houston in the course of 162 games, but that's just a team I look at and I say, well, you know, they've played so deep in the year, so many years in a row. Are they going to get tired? Are they going to get caught by a younger, fresher, wide-eyed team? Like, I'm not saying it will happen. I'm just saying it wouldn't be the strangest thing we've ever seen in this league.
And that's a division that a lot of people underestimate, that AL West. You talk about the Athletics.
I mean, don't sleep on the Angels either. The Angels too, really, I thought would be better than they are starting at 1-4. That's a team that could easily fall off the wagon real quick.
Oh, absolutely. But, I mean, the Athletics, people forget, they won like 97 games last year or something.
Yeah, they were a playoff team, right? Didn't they play the Yankees in the play-in?
Yeah, they did. And they lost, but that was probably – for a while, that's going to be the greatest win total between two teams to play in that play-in game. So you match that with the fact that the Mariners are off to a hot start. They're looking like they might be a legitimate team. The Astros have a decent concern, you know, under their belt right now. Everyone talks about the AL East and how competitive that's going to be. AL Central's obviously a joke.
Well,
the AL
Central's competitive, but it's competitive because they're all bad.
Exactly. but the AL West is going to be a tough fight for the Astros. And I think you make a good point.
Yep. All right. Alex Lebowitz dropped out there. Oh, the past there, he's back. Okay, seasons. Go ahead. Sorry. Dropped out for a second.
I'm sorry. You made a good point that when the Astros, when you have a team like the Astros that's dealt with a lot of success, like the past three, you know, over the past 3 years, like they have, it's hard to sustain that. I think the one consolation is that they have a lot of veteran leadership and they have a pretty strong-willed team. So I'm still more confident in them. I think you'll see production out of all three of the top teams from last year in the Yankees, Red Sox, and Astros. I'm not concerned about really any of them. But again, if there's one team that you know might be at the biggest detriment to start the year, it is the Yankees, in my opinion.
All right. Any individual performances that have stood out to you here through the first half a week, whatever it is?
JD Martinez. I mean, I can't remember a guy who's, you know, had such a late career, you know, emergence, I guess. He was a nobody, relatively speaking.
I can remember a lot. If you go back to the late 90s, a lot of guys emerged. I'm not saying that JD's one of those guys. No, you're right. I just, the way you worded that was funny.
Well, I mean, yeah, with the exception of that era, we'll say. Yeah. But he has been a lot of fun to watch, and he's picking up right back where he started, or right where he left off last season. So to see him, you know, hit the seams off the ball again is fun to watch. And he's a guy, again, who's facing an opt-out year. And I know Dave Dombrowski recently said they're not going to re-sign anyone else this season. Obviously, Betts is on the table, but people aren't talking enough about JD Martinez. And that's a guy who deserves to get a restructured contract because he's worth more than what he's getting paid.
Yeah, so I want to talk about the contracts here before we wrap this up. But real quick, my favorite performance, it's one swing, but Bryce Harper's first home run, I watched that like 20 times.
Yeah, that was a good one.
He knocked the top off that ball, and he's been fun to follow in Philly. I want to, before we get to our final thoughts, close it on the contracts. Xander Bogaerts got his extension, and now we're just waiting on two guys. Where I'm writing Bradley off in this. I don't think he gets extended, frankly. I don't think it matters if he does or doesn't. There's two guys out there the Red Sox need to pay. They haven't. JD Martinez and, more importantly, Mookie Betts. And what I'm worried about is we're going to relive the John Lester fiasco with Mookie Betts. I know, and I got a lot of heat on Twitter the other night when I said this. I understand that Mookie Betts says he wants to hit the open market. That's fine. He should want to hit the open market. He's going to get a boatload of money if he does. But everybody has their price. Pay him his. Keep him here. 10 years, 15 years, whatever it is. He's a generational talent. Because what did we learn with John Lester? They haggled. They lowballed. They refused to negotiate. And it ended up being more expensive for them to replace him than it would have been to sign him. Because not only did they have to go out and sign David Price, they traded for Chris Sale when Price didn't fully work out. So don't go through this again. Mm-hmm. Don't do it again with Mookie. Look, if you want something up, absurd, like $50 million per year. I understand, but I think he's going to be reasonable about this. Anything 35 or under per year, regardless of years, sign the damn deal. And his agent should know he's not going to get more than that on the open market. He's not going to get more than Trout. I would be shocked if he gets more than Trout. 35 a year, maybe a little more in the first year to offset what the arbitration cost would be. But just pay the man what he wants. He's a generational talent. You're not going to be able to replace him. And look, it's good they signed Xander Bogaerts. I actually love that contract. I'm surprised for a Boris guy, they got him for what they did without him going to the market. Re-signing Chris Sale, that contract's fine with me too. Because even when he breaks down in 2 years, he's going to be a damn good closer. But John Henry is more interested in paying his soccer players over there in England than he is about taking care of his baseball team. Run the Red Sox like a big market team, John. You developed a superstar. Now keep him. All right? Pay Mookie Betts. You can afford it. I do not want to go through what we went through with John Lester again, because that set the team back. Losing John Lester set the Red Sox back years. Make the same mistake with Mookie Betts.
I think the John Lester debacle, the handling of that, I think that was something. There's definitely something to learn from. And I think John Henry, call me, you know, overly optimistic. I think he has. And recently, within the past couple
then
months,
why doesn't Mookie Betts have a contract?
I think it's because he's probably being stubborn. He wants to hit the open market. He's. I think he's being true to his word. He has an agent who wants him to test free agency. But John Henry, within the past couple months, has stated that they handled that poorly and they should have given him what he wanted. I think you look at a Mookie Betts, besides that fact of him admitting that, Mookie Betts is a way more marketable player. And what has been important to John Henry and this Red Sox ownership over the past decade, it's getting marketable athletes. What was the phrase used? Sexy marketable athletes.
Yeah.
That's what led to them signing Pablo Sandoval. That's what led to them signing Adrian Gonzalez and Carl Crawford. And this guy who they have in front of them brings a lot less baggage than those players who were mentioned, number one. And number two, he's way more marketable, and he's an MVP. So I find it hard to believe that John Henry will let a player like this slip by him and hit the open market, number one and number two, although he probably will do that. But more importantly, go to another team. If it's under, you say $35 million or under, I think they're going to go up towards 38, towards 40. It's probably going to be that 12-year deal. It's probably going to be 11 years, but they're going to have to meet it. And I think that this is a deal that's advantageous for John Henry, too much so that he would pass it by for
figures. I just think the reason I'm concerned is the longer you take, the more you're just going to agitate him, and taking him to arbitration another time and making him play another year for $8 million. And again, this goes back to the Lester thing. At what point do you just sour the rapport between him and the organization? And do you reach a point where he just becomes so fed up that he leaves, that he rules you out as an option? That's what happened with John Lester, is they kept taking him to arbitration. They kept giving him lowball offers, and he was insulted to the fact where he wrote off the possibility of returning to the Red Sox.
Who is the president back then, and who was the GM?
And it was Lucchino. Lucchino took the brunt of the blame for that. And whether it was we'll never know whose fault that actually was, whether it was Henry, whether it was Sherrington, whoever was at fault for lowballing Lester, we'll never know the actual answer. But as an organization, there are still plenty of people in the building who were here for that. Learn mm-hmm. from your mistakes, get better.
Well, I think that said, I do think that players, I'm assuming at least, that players have a better relationship with someone like Dave Dombrowski than they do Larry Lucchino. And at the very least, he is a mediator between John Henry, if he is the one who's pulling the strings, and the players. So I think the odds of a relationship souring this season after coming off of a World Series run, I think they're lower than I don't think it's very possible. I think it's very low, the chances of that. And I think that, you know, Betts understands it's a business. He doesn't seem like a guy who has a massive ego. I trust that they'll be able to sign him because, again, he's a marketable athlete. And who else would you want? You have him right now. Why would you not want to lock him up for the money? I don't think it's ever been a huge issue for them with a guy the caliber of Mookie Betts, and I think that they will pull the trigger on this, especially since they saved some money on a Bogarts, who, you know, his average salary.
That was not a great deal. Especially for a Boris guy. Like, I don't want to gloss over that. Like, good for them. They handled that one really well. Now do it one more time with Mookie Betts, and then JD is kind of more complicated because you have the option. Look, if you have to keep one of the two, we'll just throw the price out the window. But if you were to pick one of the two, I mean, you're picking Mookie. I think that's a no-brainer. He's much younger. He's coming off an MVP. Anyway, that covers it for baseball. That was kind of the main focus of this episode. But just to keep the episode somewhat well-rounded and more so to help out the search optimization, we'll start. And we did this way back when I don't even know if we were still doing this when you joined the show, Lebowitz, but when I first started, whatever we didn't have time to fit in the main agenda, we'd just throw a final thought on it, just a minute or two on some story that's out there and just kind of a quick take. So, Lebowitz, your final thought for the show.
I love it. It's sports talk, sports journal style.
Absolutely. Right. That's where it comes from. Where do you think I get it, baby? All goes back there.
Obviously, you got it. It's the best. So my final thought, I just wanted to touch on the Michael Bennett restructuring of his contract. 2 years, $17.75 million. Includes a $4 million signing bonus, but more importantly, it clears up $700,000 in cap space, and it's restructuring for a guy who hasn't been on the field for the Patriots. We talked about this a little bit prior to the show. But I think more importantly, it shows that they're gearing up to make a move. So, you know, I like this. I think that he's absolutely, you know, dominant defensive lineman. So it's great to lock him up for a couple years. And I think the fact that Martellus was here, that vouches for his personality and how he might fit into this team. It kind of reminds me of you know, Belichick committing to a guy like Stephon Gilmore, not knowing him personally, but trusting that he would be a fit and ended up being right. Obviously, less years, less money, but still a good move. My question is, when are they going to pull the trigger and you know, acquire that wide receiver, that target that they do desperately need? Rob Gronkowski obviously retiring throws a wrench in their plans. Not that they didn't have a backup plan, if that were the case. But I think, you know, within the next coming weeks, we're going to see that deal, and we're going to see a big name, probably a high-priced skills position guy, tight end or probably wide receiver come aboard. And I think that this move clearing up some cap space, even though it's only $700,000, that's going to contribute to locking down a guy to help out Brady next season.
And don't forget, we still have the draft too, and a lot of course. You know, there's a lot of speculation that there's going to be a big playmaker in the first round.
My and Braxton Berrios is coming back.
That's right. Hey, me and Evan have been saying nonstop. People are sleeping on Braxton Berrios way too much. So I don't know that this is his breakout year. I think it's one more year, kind of like Edelman and Welker's relationship. But anyway, my final thought. A lot of people know I not literally, but emotionally was very invested in the AAF. I think minor league football is something that would really help out the sport. I think it would help the NFL. And the AAF today announcing that they're ceasing operations. And I want to make this very clear, because people will laugh and compare it to the USFL and the UFL and the original XFL and all that and say, oh, nobody cares about football. It's not the NFL and nobody's going to watch it. They didn't fold because they were out of money. They actually had enough money and they had plenty of interest. Sure, some markets were struggling, but you look in places like San Antonio and Orlando, and they were drawing good crowds. In fact, one of my biggest takeaways from this whole thing is that if the NFL is going to relocate a team, whether it be Oakland not working out in Vegas or realizing the two teams don't fit in LA and moving the Chargers, I think San Antonio is ready for an NFL team. But it really is a shame, because what it sounds like happened, and none of this has been directly confirmed, but Tom Dundon, who owns the Carolina Hurricanes, came in as a late investor for the AAF 2 weeks into the season, when the team did need the money. And I think that was part of their business plan all along, was that they were going to have to bring in an investor midseason, and he pledged $250 million. And he was going to take over paying the players and all of that. And part of that was he got full control of the league. He took control over from Charlie Ebersole and Bill Polian. And today it's saying he pulled the rug out from under it, basically, even though they're financially not sustained, but you know, they're doing well enough financially. And a lot of people think it's because when he took over as the head of the board of directors, it was in his contract that he could make the sole decision to pull the rug out. And if the league were to go under, he would have the opportunity to sell off all the league's assets. One of those assets is a copyright for some sports gambling software that the AAF was developing. Charlie Ebersole originally described the league as a gambling company that ran a football league. So, you know, maybe this is the next DraftKings or FanDuel, and he spent $70 million of his own dollars to get into something that's going to make him $500 million to you know, however much, and you know, good for him for doing that. It's a, you know, capitalist society, but you know, this is just a real shot to the gut to minor league football. This is a league that actually had a chance to work, and to see him tank it like that just really hurts. And I just, you know, in the last 3 days, you've had three pretty, you know, not top tier sports leagues, but three pretty prevalent sports leagues. And the CWHL, the Canadian Women Hockey League, folded on Sunday. Yesterday, you had the MLL severely cut back operations, not fold, but they're essentially going through a 2-year probation period. They eliminated three franchises. And then you had the AAF today, and it sucks to see opportunities for access for sport. You know, not everybody can go and get a job in the NFL or the NBA right away, or the NHL. You kind of need either college sports, and in some ways these stepstone leagues as well. You need a minor league system. It's not just for players. It's for broadcasters. It's for front office people. It's for, you know, a whole range of people to hone their skills. And it sucks to see these kind of opportunities go away, especially because something that's always gotten under my skin is how much power sports betting has over the actual games. And I lump fantasy into this, but it sounds like Dundon was going to scrap the league altogether just for the gambling software. And you shouldn't sacrifice games to bet on for the betting software. Like, that's just fundamentally wrong for me. So we can get into that another time, because this is way more than I wanted to talk about it. This is just another example. And hey, look, if you want to gamble on sports, that's fine. I have nothing against it. It should be legal. But it's just everything about the way this went down just bugs the hell out of me. And I think it's wrong. And I just want people to understand, look, the UFL was a joke. The FXFL was a joke. I support all these startup football leagues, but I recognize when they're destined to fail. This is a league that was destined to succeed that got into bed with the wrong person. This, if anything, is Donald Trump with the USFL more so than any of these other leagues. It's an individual that came in with the wrong intentions and relatively knowingly buried the league. So that's my rant on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's definitely a need there for a minor league team. Some would argue that it's the AFL or the CFL. And those are obviously alternatives, but no one in the States is really watching the CFL, and the AFL is pretty much an entirely different game if you boil it down. So, I mean, the XFL is coming up.
I want minor league NFL football.
You want it to be directly associated, call-ups, call-downs, that type of thing?
Look, it doesn't have to be directly associated in theory, but I think what this failure tells us is that it does. In all practicality, if it's going to succeed, it can't just be an NFL-supported entity. It has to be an NFL-owned, an NFL-controlled entity. And when we will get that, I don't know. The CFL is great. I actually do enjoy watching it in the summer. Arena football is entertaining as hell. I know there's a lot of jokes about it, but it's really fun to watch. But those are both different sports. Give me 100-yard field, 11-a-side, all of that, and give me a minor league opportunity for that.
I just think you'd get a lot of – I don't think you'd have the talent necessarily, because when you need the funds to pay these guys – and football is one of those sports where players, you know, once they get towards the end of it or once their opportunities run dry – I feel like football more than any other sport is one where players are accepting of the fact that they're giving up. Well, because of the baggage that comes injury wise.
And I'll just say this: the money part. Mm-hmm. None of this is easy. If I mean to make it sound easy, it's not.
Oh, yeah,
starting a minor league system, but the argument that's always been made against minor league football is players won't play meaningless games because of the injury risk. And I think there is some truth to that. But you look at what happened today. With the AAF news coming so suddenly, all of the players and coaches kind of were trying to figure out a Hail Mary to save the league. These guys wanted to keep playing. They believed this was their chance to get into the NFL. This was their last chance. So, there is some truth to not playing meaningless games, and, you know, there should be, you know, you could talk about the NFL preseason, all of that. If it's minor leagues or no football, I think more guys than not will play minor leagues. So, I really hope and I don't think the XFL is going to be it. I think they have a worse business plan than the AAF did. I don't have a lot of hopes for that. So right now, for me, it looks like the future of minor league football is up in the air. All right. We said these are going to be 20 to 25 minute episodes. We're pushing 30 here. We'll be back on Friday or Saturday, maybe Thursday.
Thursday, probably, because I'm going to be in New York City this weekend.
Okay. Well, we'll have another show. Follow us on Twitter at Calling the Podcast to keep track. When we'll talk about whatever the big headline is. So until then, for Alex Lubbock, I'm Alex Barth. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time.